Now, it's time for another edition of
Cannonball!
The Cannons Blue Jackets Roundtable.
Here's Nash stepping in by one. Score! Cracked
it! Here's your host, Dan P.
What's up, everybody? It's Dan P. here. We're back with Blue Jackets Roundtable. A little while since we've last graced you with our presence, and we have a special treat for you this time around. I'm joined tonight by Jeff Little from 10 Minute Misconduct. Jeff, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, Dan?
Very well. Opening night's Friday, so obviously I'm doing very well. So
can't come soon enough.
Yeah, exactly. We've got plenty to talk about. Obviously, the biggest thing is now that training camp is over, we have a really good look at what our lineup is probably going to look like Friday. And the first thing I really wanted to talk to you about is the notion that despite, the acquisitions made over the summer, at the end of the day, we still have, at least on opening night, we still have four rookies that are going to be playing a role on this team. And I wanted to get your take on that and, just kind of get a feeling from you if you think that's indicative of issues the team will have or if you think that those guys can succeed.
Well, Arneil said on Media Day that he wasn't going to give any rookie a spot unless they were clearly superior to a veteran. So the fact that four have made it, and it's really five if you count Dekanich, who's going to be miss the first little bit, but he's a rookie at the NHL level as well. So I don't think it's a problem. I don't think it's indicative of a problem with the club. Jack Welch, who used to be the CEO of General Electric, used to say that his goal was to replace the bottom 10% of his workforce every year. And that's how he got better. GE's been around for a long time and been a very successful company. Blue Jackets can't say they've had that much success the last couple of years. So there should be some jobs available. And there were. And these rookies came in and took them. There were some openings. There were some gaps where there weren't veterans who clearly had the position. There are others where veterans had sort of a tenuous hold on them. I'm thinking of Dorsett, Bull, that level of player. And, they were warned. Mayeroff was talked about last spring at the end of the year, and Arneil said that, he's got his game, and Housen said he's got his game, and he's going to come in and really contend. And Mayeroff did. He contended from day one of camp all the way through. So it's really not a surprise to see him. There was going to be a spot, at least one spot, for a rookie defenseman. So that was just a matter of which of the people was going to take it. And right now it looks like it's Savard. And he played really well all through camp. Aaron Johnson, I suppose, is in the running as well. But he doesn't quite impress me as much. And, you've got Ryan Johansson, which I've said from day one was a no-brainer. I mean, this kid has absolutely nothing to learn back in juniors, with Portland. And my only question was coming into camp, did he have the size and the physical play to be able to hang with the players? And I think he showed that early on. I think he showed that he was able to take the body, to play the physical game, and hold his own, which, is then the one surprise was Cam Atkinson, who even Arneil said today that he never really expected Cam to make the lineup. But Cam is just a case of a guy who played his way into the lineup. He was always around the puck. He made some shots. He made some smart decisions, and he was put in a lot of different positions with a lot of different players. So I think you have to tip your hat to Atkinson, and it's not like he's coming out of 1 year of juniors or coming out of high school or something like that. He played 3 years at a top college program. He's got an NCAA title. So I don't think, it's not like he's not used to competition. And he's certainly used to having people calling him short. So.
Well, and I was going to say, the one thing that stuck out to me when I talked to Ryan Johansson was how much size he actually has put on in the last year. And I think your point is very well taken. There was really no reason for him to go back to Portland. And you did touch on Atkinson, and that was a guy I wanted to talk about. Every time you see him play, the thing that strikes me is that he's just, for his size, is so hard to get off the puck. and he has the skill around the net. But even with that said, are you surprised at all to see him playing on the second line?
Yes and no. I'm surprised to start that he's going to start off on the second line. But again, Arneil's got a couple of different tasks here. He needs to get a blend of skills and a blend of players on each line so that he's got, guys who are shooters, guys who are a little physical, guys who can position themselves in front of the net. Plus, then, I think he needs to I don't think he wants to throw a line of rookies out there. I mean, you could throw a Mayer off Atkinson, Johansson line out there. But I think Arneil would have a heart attack every time the puck came into our own end. So you really want to balance it. And especially Brassard, I think, has looked very good with the move to wing, but he's still going to need some games to fully integrate that, fully get that into, prime time performance situations, get used to picking up the correct defensive assignment coming back as opposed to the center ice slot. I think Brassard has looked very good at the wing. I've always, in fact, before Arneil started to do that this camp, I've always thought that Brassard looked more like a natural winger than a natural center. He's got the speed, he's got the shot, and his passing ability is really a great asset from the wing. It's something that we kind of lack, because Nash is a good shooter, not a great passer. He's a good passer, he's not a great passer. Umberger, to tell the truth, isn't really great with the puck one way or another. I mean, he can stand in front of the net and he can get the short shots and he can get the occasional slapper passed, but he's not a puck handler. He's not a guy you want to bring the puck up. But Brassard is going to need some time to get that wing position, being fully comfortable under game conditions, knowing how to pick up the defensive assignments, those types of things. So Atkinson on the top two lines, I think he brings that hustle. I think he brings some of that ability to keep the puck in play, keep the puck in the zone. With Vermette and Umberger, he's got the veteran help there that he'll need, with Umberger providing the more physical presence, Vermette the skill of passing, and hopefully Vermette will uncork his shot a little bit more this year because he'll have some stable line mates. So yes, it's a surprise, but given all the things that Arneil has to do with these lines, it's not a shock.
And you touched on Brassard a little bit there, and one of the things that first popped into my head when I saw him, playing on that fourth line is what you touched on with the notion of a learning curve to kind of learn to play the wing. And so I don't necessarily look at that as a demotion, but I wanted to get your sense on how long you think he stays on that fourth line if he really takes to playing the wing. Do you think at some point he might move up and push Atkinson down?
First of all, I think we're going to have to get rid of the notion of a fourth line, because we've been so many years now with the very traditional thing. We've got two scoring lines. You've got our top six. We have a checking line, the third line, and then we have the fourth line, who's there to traditionally take up space and energy and give the other guys a break, basically. We've got enough talent now that we've got three scoring lines, and I like to look at this one as the third line and the other one is the checking line. So I'm looking at it as we got three lines and a checking line, because when you got Derek Brassard, Maxime Mayeroff, and Ryan Johansson playing together on a line, they're not just going to be hitting people. They're going to be putting some pucks in the net. As far as whether he moves up and replaces, moves up, quote unquote, and replaces, Atkinson, it's just all going to, it's going to be the hot hand, and I'm not sure whether moving up is even a right term. Arneil is going to have the flexibility. If Brassard's line is doing great, or Johansson's line, I guess, since he's the center, they'll get more ice time than Vermette's line if Vermette's line's not playing that well. And he may try things like that for a while. I get a sense that he will try to keep these lines together for the first little bit to allow them some time to build some chemistry. I think that was one of the knocks on Hitchcock. That was, a valid criticism, that if the guy didn't get it done in two periods, he was on the bench or he was on the fourth line or he was somewhere else, and these guys never had a chance to really work together and get a chemistry.
Yeah, I definitely agree there. And, along that line, the other forward question I really wanted to ask you about is the top line. Obviously, you know, with Nash and Carter. Obviously, everybody's been looking forward to that all summer. But what we're seeing now is Prospel on that line, which is not unexpected. But I think, at least from my perspective, given last season, I assumed Nash would stay on the left side, and it appears that he might be moving back to the right. And I wonder if you know, to your eyes, that's a good move if Nash is more of a natural right winger to you, and also just how you see, you know, Prospel fitting in with those two guys, given that he's got the hands to set them up almost game in and game out.
Well, starting with Prospel, I think you're exactly right. First of all, he's been around. He's played with some very good people in various teams he's been with, and so he gets it. He knows how to play with this caliber of player. He's not going to be awed by these guys. He's going to take his own shots, but he's also got the skill to feed the puck. I think the biggest question with Prospel with the knee is, does he have the speed to keep up? And how will that knee hold out over 82 games? But I think for the short term, he's going to be great. I mean, I think he looked better in camp than I expected him to in terms of his speed and quickness. Nash, I think, can play either wing. I don't think it matters. And you may see this flip-flop again, and if it doesn't appear to take hold, you know, immediately. You know, I could see Prospel going the other side and Nash coming. I think Arneal will give this a chance to work. But I also wouldn't rule out something like Brassard moving all the way up once he got really comfortable at wing. Arneal's got a luxury that a coach hasn't had here in a long time. Of having enough talent to kind of mix and match and hopefully get results. So it'll be a work in progress, and it won't be seamless because these guys do need to build some chemistry. But it's going to be a fun one to watch. I mean, they showed that they can score during the preseason, and I know it's just preseason, but they were putting the puck in the net with some pretty good regularity.
Yeah, most definitely. And one of the things you touched on in the discussion about rookies was David Savard. And obviously, with James Wisniewski out for those first eight games, he's going to play a big role as that right-handed shot. Throughout those first eight games, if Savard is, you know, doesn't look overwhelmed and is actually, you know, playing well, is Chris Russell the guy that's in trouble once Wisniewski comes back?
Yeah, could well be. I mean, Chris is going to have to play well. There's no question about it. He's shown in the past, and he showed during camp. He had some excellent intervals during camp, and then he had intervals in camp that he disappeared. And that's been the knock on Chris, is that when he's on, he's terrific. I mean, he absolutely carries the play and can pick people up. When he's not on, he's just there. It's not that he makes horrendous mistakes in his own zone. It's not that he's just not contributing in the way that Chris Russell is designed to do. Chris Russell isn't on the ice to be a shutdown defensive guy physically. He's there to be competent in his own end and get the puck out of his own end quickly and create scoring chances at the other end. If he can't do that regularly, his utility becomes marginal, especially when you've got a Savard who seemed very comfortable in really all situations. That was one of the things that really impressed me and that I was, you know, looking to see when we played the last couple of exhibition games without Wisniewski, to see what the power play would do. And the power play, you know, looked good. Nobody has a rocket quite like Wisniewski, but with Savard and Tootin up atop, they had a really good chemistry going. And, you know, Tootin put a laser in there on one of the power plays and, had an assist on another. So, yeah, I think Russell's the guy on the bubble. Aaron Johnson, I don't know what the club thinks of Johnson right now. I haven't, you know, he hasn't done anything to make me stand up and take notice. But, you know, in eight games, we're going to find out. I think Arneal is going to have to be convinced that Johnson is a keeper for the long haul for him to push out somebody like Russell. But, you know, if Russell is going to be the loser in this thing, I would fully expect Housen to engineer a trade, if for nothing else than draft picks. I know that, the Rangers are supposedly out there looking for defensemen, and, I'm surprised, shocked that they aren't calling Wade Redden back from Switzerland. But, I guess their budget can't handle it after signing Brad Richards.
Okay, well, the only position we really haven't talked about is obviously the one probably with the biggest question mark, and that's Steve Mason. Obviously, to my eyes, he looked more efficient with his movements. He looked more confident with his movements in the preseason, and you know, as a result of that, I feel like for the most part we saw the Calder Cup at least close to that level of ability from him. Do you think that that's, you know, is Mason back to that level potentially, or you know, is it more just competition level of play in the preseason?
Well, no, I think goalies for the most part, you know, they get closer to game level play during the preseason, simply because you know they've got some rookie defenders out there who hang them out to dry on a regular basis, and you got a bunch of guys coming the other direction who are trying to make a name and trying to. I mean, I've never seen Mason get hit so frequently by opposing players than I did this preseason. But if you look at the numbers, I mean, he played four games. He was 4-0. He saved 113 out of 121 shots. He had a .934 save percentage and a 1.98 goals against average. Yeah, those are good numbers anytime. And he made some really, really good, you know, good saves. What impressed me most about him were three things, which showed me that Ian Clark was a good hire. Yeah, first, he was calm. You know, in his rookie year, our seats are right behind the attack twice goal, and the game in his rookie year against the Capitals, where we actually won both games 3-0, but the one at Nationwide, I was watching Mason, and the thing that struck me about him, especially for a big guy, was how he suddenly appeared where he needed to be. You weren't conscious of him moving across the crease. It was just like all 1 minute he's on the left post and the next minute he's on the right post, and you're not sure how he got there. You know, and I'm in contrast, I'd point to Pascal Leclerc, who was all elbows and knees and hands and wrists, and he was flailing around, and he had that style of goaltending, but you always knew when Pazzi was moving somewhere, because you know it looked like he looked closer to an octopus out there. Mason looked more like a sliding wall when he was playing well, and that's what he looked like this preseason. He was moving out, and he stayed out high. He stayed out to the front of the crease. I mean, obviously, when the puck was behind him or the puck was along the goal line, you know, he came down to the goal line and to protect the post. But for the most part, he seemed to be positionally sound. He wasn't overplaying pucks, and he had good rebound control. When he wasn't catching the puck, he was directing it off into the corner. Just generally seemed calm. He wasn't hanging his head if he let a goal in. He just seemed to be a little more comfortable in his own skin.
Definitely, definitely. Well, let's turn for a minute to an area that I know is an area that you have a great deal of expertise in, and that is the proposed deal for the arena lease issue. Mm-hmm. Yes. Obviously, last night, Monday night, the City Council, Columbus City Council, passed a 6-0 vote to approve that proposal. And so it moves on to the mayor's office and the commissioner's office. Do you see any reason why it won't make it past those other two hurdles?
No. I mean, this is a done deal. I mean, I wrote several months ago that when and if a deal was announced, it was going to be a done deal by the time it was announced, all but the official votes, because there is no incentive for a politician to come out and announce something like this without it being a done deal. They can't risk having this thing announced and a big fanfare made and then go to the, you know, go to the city council vote and all of a sudden you lose, you know, 5-2. There's no incentive for them to do that. And the Blue Jackets have been acutely aware, and Nationwide has been acutely aware of the problems of publicity since, you know, since this issue first came to light back in 2009. The prospect, the proposal for an increased sin tax that was floated around originally was leaked well before that had, you know, taken any real shape, and scuttled it before, and the public reaction scuttled it before it ever got going. There's been some other rumors and so forth that have been leaked out or been aired correctly or incorrectly that have caused issues behind the scenes in getting this deal done. So for a while now, the principals have really shut down the communication lines on this, and they were going to stay in a closed room basically until this deal got done, and they had a unanimous city council and a unanimous county commissioners board, and we're ready to go. But by the same token, it wasn't just getting a bunch of people to agree. It had to be a deal that made sense all the way around, and that's what I think they got.
So along that line, you talked about several of the possible items. Is this most likely, in your estimation, the best possible situation for the Blue Jackets in terms of how this deal helps their lease issue?
Yeah, and keep in mind, this isn't a, yes, the Blue Jackets are a beneficiary of this, but it really goes down to how you handle arenas in the public sector, in the private sector. The economic model that's been pursued here was not their choice, right? Their choice was to have a temporary tax increase that would have built the arena, but that got scuttled in 1997. The powers that be wanted to still have a hockey team here, so they had 6 weeks to put a deal together. Nationwide has been the only single sports tenant, privately built, privately operated arena in the country. And that causes problems in the long term because of exactly the things you've seen here. The Blue Jackets were responsible for much of the operation of the arena, yet they didn't own the arena, nor did they get all the revenue from the arena that other things do. So, and everybody that's looked at it, from the Glenn Institute to the NHL, has come in and said, no, your hockey operations are fine. It's your arena situation that's killing you. Arenas are public assets in most communities. Sure, there are private ownership deals that you see out there, but those are usually where you have one guy or one company that owns both an NHL team and an NBA team, has all the television rights that go along with that, and then owns the building. That's what you usually see. That way you get, and usually in a major city, a Boston, a Chicago, a New York, those types of things, because those are the A-list cities for Broadway shows and those types of things. They don't have trouble filling the building that many nights a year. Okay. Totally different the situation when you're talking about cities like Columbus, like Nashville, these types.
Well, especially when you have a city that has two arenas in it.
Well, yeah, and I'm not even going to get into to that whole thing and what agreements were made with Ohio State and what Ohio State did as opposed to what they were supposed to do. We're not even going to get into that, and I'll direct people to 10-Minute Misconduct, and they can read all about that in my Arena Chronicles series. But the reason this is a good deal for everybody is at the bottom line, since the arena was built, and since because nobody, let's face it, this community did not believe in 1997 that anything could happen and be done with the old Penn site and that area. It was an economic wasteland. There was nothing there. And people weren't willing to gamble their own dollars in terms of a new tax to see if something could be done. Well, those people were wrong. That area has put $350 million of tax revenue, just of tax revenue, back into the public coffers over the last 10 years at really no cost to the taxpayer, other than some road improvements that were done by the city at the time that the arena was built. But those would have to have been done anyway. So, you're going to get an arena that cost $175 million to build. You're going to get it for $42.5 million. Nationwide's loaning you the money until the casino revenue starts. The casino revenue, a brand new source of revenue, will more than cover that. And it sounds crazy, but in this day and age, $42.5 million is nothing.
No.
If the Convention and Facilities Authority wanted to go out and buy and build a new addition to the convention center,
good luck.
they'd be talking $150, $175 million project.
Yeah.
Easy. So they have got an annex to the convention center for $42.5 million. Now, sure, has Nationwide gotten some stuff out of this? Absolutely. Okay. You know, they'll take a huge tax loss on this. They got a sweetheart deal for the land in the Arena District, which they developed and own. So, and those valuations have all gone up quite nicely. So their balance sheet has improved tremendously. But the thing from the Blue Jacket standpoint is they've gotten what they were after all along, is just they've got a lease situation that puts them on par with every other team in the league. Mm-hmm. They're going to get the revenues from the arena that other teams get. They're going to have, they won't pay rent like other teams don't pay rent, because you don't make your money off of the rent that the team pays. You make your rent, your money off of the economic activity the team mm-hmm. brings. That's how the public entity makes its money. But for the Blue Jackets, they got the predictability, and that's it. I talked an hour and a half with Mike Priest about it, and that's what they were looking for, is predictability. They needed to know that they could do this, because except for the last couple of years when attendance dropped off rather significantly, they were pretty much a break-even operation on hockey operations. The 12 million, the 10 to 12 million they were losing really came out of the arena related expenses and the combination of expenses and the revenue that they were deprived of. So, they've been true to their word, because, now look, on the one hand, you can say, look, they paid $80 million for the franchise fee. The Forbes values it at $153 million, and Nationwide is spending $52 million to acquire a 30% interest. So that comes out to about $173.3 million. So they've done rather nicely in terms of value. But theoretical value is theoretical mm-hmm. value. My stocks are worth X amount of money today. My 401k is worth X amount of money today. That's theoretical unless I cash it all in. Yeah. You don't want to be in a situation where your professional sports franchise is sitting there losing money on a cash basis each year, but is increasing in value. Because that's the sort of situation where you're saying, well, the owner's going to say, well, I'm going to realize that gain in value, and the only way you can mm-hmm. do that is sell. Now, now with the Blue Jackets having committed to stay until 2039 at least, I mean, this city has a guarantee that I'm not aware of existing in any other city. Where a professional sports franchise has said, we guarantee that we will stay in town through 2039, and that's more than just it's an express agreement. It's not just that the lease runs through 2039. It's that the club says we're going to stay in town. We're going to play professional hockey in this town until 2039. Otherwise, we're going to have to pay you $36 million.
And I'm led to believe there was also language that they have to spend a certain amount based on the salary cap, so they can't just hover at the salary floor and pocket money. I don't know if that's correct or not, or if you have any knowledge.
I have not heard anything about that, and I'd be surprised if they would do. I can't picture a business owner doing that. I think it's been a big, people have fantasized like to say that, we've been a budget team and so forth and so on, and we haven't spent what we should. Well, that's, if you look at the record, that's not really true. Look at the Floridas and so forth. Now, those are budget teams. Those are teams where are picking up anybody. I mean, my God, Florida brings in Brian Campbell and that contract, just so they can get to the floor.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. But you have to look at the character of the team. Housen is not a guy. Housen's not like the guys in Chicago, okay? He doesn't want to be in a situation where every year he has to unload half the roster to reconfigure the salary cap. But Housen had a lot of youngsters in those early years. And the thing you got to worry about when you've got that many youngsters is when they come off of their entry-level deal, that's going to be a big raise. And he had a lot of guys coming off of entry-level deals. Broussard, Voracek, Mason, all these guys were going to come off of entry-level deals. Plus when he got here, of course, he had the contracts with Fedorov and Foote. So He had to leave a pretty big gap between the salary cap and what he was actually spending in hard dollars, because that gap was going to get filled by those guys coming off of entry-level deals.
Well, at this point, let's we'll circle back around to entry-level deals makes me think of rookies. We'll do a quick a quick line of just some quick-fire questions. I just want to get your take. Which rookie steps up the most once the season starts?
Steps up the most. I'm going to say Mayeroff.
Okay. Which one might be the first one to go back to Springfield?
Wow, that's a tough one. Johansson can't go anywhere. So unless you get sent to juniors after 9 games, and that's not happening. So of the three, probably Atkinson.
Okay. What are the realistic expectations for the top line in terms of, you know, what do you see? I'm not going to nail you down to numbers, but just what kind of a scoring impact do you see from that line?
I expect that line to be 100 goal line.
Right. As it stands today, what is the biggest weakness on this team?
I think there's still some concern about at least my concern about the blue line. Just in terms of, you know, the shutdown ability. I think Tootin is solid, and I think Wisniewski is going to be solid. If both of those guys stay healthy, that's great. Martinik is solid when healthy, but he's had injury problems. Okay. After that, I get a little concerned. I take a lot of heat for this, but I am not a big Mathot believer yet. I see too many times where he's, you know, standing there watching as the guy stands at the post and takes 2 shots at Mason. This happened the other night. I've seen too many times where he's doing snow angels on the ice while a guy skates around him. He's going to have to really step up this year and show that he is a defenseman. And it's not enough to put your body on somebody. You got to finish the check. I mean, he puts his body on the guy, but the guy doesn't lose the puck, you know, and being responsible and staying put, he will wander from that area in front of the net. And so that concerns me. I mean, I think we have some talent, and I think these young guys are going to push some of the older guys, and they've all got some skating skill, which is nice to see. The one thing I saw repeatedly in the preseason was we did a really pretty good job of getting the puck out of our zone for the most part. I mean, there were times when we got bogged down, but for the most part, the defensemen were very good about getting that first pass going, which is going to be essential for us. But that's the thing I'm really concerned about is just how that blue line responds. I think there are certain players. I think Russell, I think some of the youngsters, I think even Mathot may have a very short leash because, you know, you've got Holden, you've got, you've got Johnson, you've got, Russell, you've got Golubev, who's a terrific young player too. These guys are all sitting there ready and waiting to go. I mean, they're lined up like airplanes in a holding pattern. And if guys don't perform, I don't think Arneil's gonna hang around.
Okay.
Very long.
Of all the players coming back from last year's team, who takes the step forward and who takes the biggest step back?
Biggest step forward. Well, I'm going to be consistent. I think Brassard's going to take a big step forward. He's got too much game not to, and I think getting him off of that line or out of a situation where he's the center of Nash's line, he gets out of that mode of constantly looking for Nash to feed the puck to him. I think he got kind of caught up in this thing because he's a terrific passer, but he bypassed a lot of his own opportunities last year. And when you pass up enough opportunities, you start losing confidence in your shot, and it kind of builds on itself. So hopefully by being in a different situation and being on the wing, he'll be relied on to be less of a playmaker, will take more of his own shots, but yet he still has that passing ability. So I think he's going to be take a big step forward. Of the returning guys taking a step back, I'd hate to say anybody. I think my biggest concern, I'm going to stick with it, is Mathot on the defensive side, and on the offensive side. And since Bol is injured, is Dorsett. Dorsett is going to have to show that he can be a mature individual on the ice. He doesn't bring skill with the puck. He brings hustle. He brings grit, and he can hit. But you know, we've shown last year, and we've shown this year with Atkinson and with Mayeroff, you can have a guy that does all that and has skill too. But you know, Dorsett takes way too many penalties at the wrong time. He takes way too many majors and way too many 10-minute and game misconducts. He spends too much time getting in fights when we're in the offensive zone, making checks that are needless. He'll make a hit without playing the puck when he could have played the puck. That sort of stuff needs to stop because we've got enough talent now where we don't need an enforcer role. We don't, there aren't roster spots on many clubs anymore that are just for pure enforcers. Calling Dorsett an enforcer is stretching it a bit, but he's a great guy. Dorsett's a great guy to watch because he's all, elbows and knees and he hustles, and he looks for like he's putting forth tremendous effort. But if you watch, he's not that fast. And you always think of a guy who hits a lot and so forth as being great in the defensive zone. And he really isn't. In a normal defensive situation, Derek guards a lot of air. And now he's good on the PK, no question about it. He's good on the PK because he puts that aggressive forecheck on, which he loves to do. But you watch him come back up ice, he's kind of a chugger. So I think he and Mathod are the guys that I'm watching. If anybody's going to take a slide back, I'd think.
Okay, and the final question, of course, I have to ask it. Assuming general health of a hockey team, where does this team finish this year, and how many points?
Boy, I've been thinking about that because I'm writing my final preview for 10-minute misconduct, and I'm trying to come up with a conclusion. My gut tells me that they're going to end up about fifth or sixth. But to be honest with you, they could win the division. If these guys meld, they have enough talent and enough scoring potential that they could do anything. I think realistically, for the first eight games, you want to see him without Wisniewski and getting to know each other. I'm happy with a 4-4, 5-3 record the first eight games. But I sort of expect it to ramp up from there. So, I would certainly expect at least mid-90s and probably pushing 100 points.
All right. I'll take it. We'll wrap it up with that. You heard it here first. Jeff Little, they could win the division. I like it. All right, Jeff Little from 10-Minute Misconduct, thanks very much for joining us. And
thanks, Dan.
No problem. Thanks,
it.
Everybody, for listening.
This has been another edition of the Cannons Blue Jackets Roundtable. Thanks for listening.